Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
The sleep of reason gives birth to monsters.
Hi, my name's Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, post-apocalyptic wasteland, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1960s to today. Check us out at reallyawfulmovies.com, part of the Crypt TV family.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 7, a look back at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
All right, so in our last podcast, we were talking sort of about some of the seminal films that got us into horror, and we talked about Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Now, Chris was saying that he watched it when he was young.
Really young, with a bunch of friends.
And
yeah, we were so terrified of what might happen. Because we were 12 years old, that we were watching it from a pull-out couch, and we were ready to, like a drawbridge, lift the end of the bed so that if anything really frightening or gory happened, we wouldn't see it. Of course, it prompts the question why we didn't just cover our eyes, but someone had this idea and thought it'd be a good idea. So yeah, that left an indelible stamp on me for sure. So it was probably the first bona fide horror I'd ever seen.
Okay.
And the third overall like scary movie I'd ever seen.
Right. So, and you were saying
just revisited it recently, and
well, I mean, I've revisited many times. I've seen it probably about 30 times. But I mean, you said you were terrified about what would happen, and you also mentioned in the last podcast that
it wasn't that gory, really, in retrospect, and they really pulled their punches in terms of you know, the gratuitous violence, and it was more the psychological,
right,
which made it really effective.
So, I mean, back then you're a young kid, and you wanted
to see chainsaws tearing into flesh because that's what you anticipated,
right?
And at the time, we showed some false bravado, saying, "Oh, this is ridiculous," because we thought it was tame.
Mm-hmm.
But little did we know, it was actually a fantastic psychological thriller. And it really holds up to this day.
Well, the reality is that TCM is basically, it's sort of a movie where its reputation precedes itself. I mean, you hear the title alone, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, certain images come into your head, right? And you anticipate that this is going to be like the bloodiest, goriest movie you've ever seen.
In a way you would not have had it been called Head Cheese, its original title.
Head Cheese is one, Another Face is being another, yep. Yeah, no, it's really funny because, I mean, TCM is a sort of movie that works on you. Don't get me wrong, it's a visceral movie. It's a hard horror movie, but it's not the gore fest that most people think it is.
No.
It is. What it is it's a movie that sort of worms its way into your consciousness. It scares you. It unnerves you. But it's not the...
Yeah, it's not the ne plus ultra violent, nasty gore one would think. In fact, it has more in common with maybe something like Deliverance than anything else.
That's what I was
thinking too, because it's got the hillbillies, and it's got the more the urbanites, I guess you could call them. And even though, I mean, Texas is really divided into two. There's Dallas and Houston, Austin, where this was lensed, and basically everything else. So you go a few miles outside these major centers, and you're in places that are off the beaten path.
Well, one of the things Toby Hooper said when he was talking about the genesis of making Texas Chainsaw Massacre is that one of the things he wanted to exploit was the urbanites' fear of the rural...
The other.
And in this case being the rural sort of farmer, you know. There's been a lot of sort of, like, I guess you would say, hillbilly horror movies that came in the wake.
Exploitation
came in the wake of Texas, but nothing quite as effective nor as long-lasting in terms of the influence of Texas Chainsaw. So, I mean, we're talking about the reputation of Texas Chainsaw and how it sort of precedes itself, and you sort of put it in. And right off the bat, you're expecting just, like, you want to see, like, you know, limbs being hacked into right away, connective tissue being severed, you know, blood, guts, gore. I mean, it's there, but you know what? A lot of Texas is basically what you're not seeing.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, the mind, when you watch this movie, this is the brilliance of the movie, is that the mind connects it. The mind fills in the blanks quite a bit. In fact, our friend Lewis, who runs Suspect Video, this
Suspect Video is a one of the best video stores, in the world.
Right. Say.
But we're lucky to live steps from it, and he has every film.
Right.
He's a wealth of information about this kind of thing.
So Lewis, I mean, we were talking about TCM one day, and he said to me that people will come, will come to the store, rent the movie, come back and say, "Hey, what did you do? You rented me the cut version."
Yeah.
I wanted the uncut version, the one that I saw when I was a kid, the one with all the, the heads being severed and so on and so forth, because, because their memory, their recollection is that this movie had so much more gore, so much more, I guess it was, for lack of a better word, chainsaw action than what it really had. It's there. It's there, but it's done in such a way that the viewer puts it there. So, I mean, Lewis has to basically say, no, this is the uncut version of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So that, I mean, it's kind of funny. So you talked about, renting this movie as a kid and, really being, geared up for this, extremely,
yeah. And, disappointed, but in actuality, if you were to check our mental state, probably relieved at that point that it wasn't the gore fest, because we wouldn't have been equipped to handle it.
Now, I mean, did it have any sort of lasting psychological effect on you when you were a kid, or?
I remember the opening credits. I remember John Larroquette and the sort of faux documentary of this really happened and whatnot. And that really had a lasting impact, as did the grandpa. Because obviously as a kid, a grandpa is such an important figure in your life. And when you see these people, the way they're depicted in that attic, oh my God, that really stuck with me.
Well, I mean, that's another thing, too, that Hooper and Kim Henkel, the writer of the movie, and they want to explore, too, was the dynamics of the family.
Family,
and
generational.
Yes. Given the name Sawyer in the sequel, Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2, but really in Part 1, they weren't really given a name, although in Gunnar Hansen's book, he says their name was actually Slaughter, the Slaughter family.
We Slaughter was apparently on that gas station.
Exactly.
The family owned it, but who noticed that?
But I mean, this was a family that was basically hit by hard economic times. They were workers at the local slaughterhouse who were put out of a job. You have this really warped family dynamic in the sense that you have grandpa, living basically comatose yet adolescent grandpa living upstairs. You got the older brother, the cook, played wonderfully by Jim Siodow.
Yeah, he's incredible.
You got the hitchhiker played by Ed O'Neill, another brother, and then you got Bubba.
Ed O'Neill from American Children?
Ed Neill, sorry.
Modern Family. For younger viewers.
But, Ed Neill, and then you had Bubba, otherwise known as Leatherface, played by Gunnar Hansen.
Gunnar Hansen,
whose
book we just read. It's fantastic.
Yes,
for anyone out there, just check it out.
The family is something that's definitely explored in Texas Chainsaw, and the breakdown of the family, sort of like
nuclear family.
Yeah, indeed.
It's breakdown.
So before we talk about that too much, I want to talk about how I sort of saw TCM for the first time. In the last podcast, I talked about getting into horror rather late. I talked about working at this Warp video store that had like the weirdest back catalog ever. They didn't have Texas Chainsaw Massacre. They didn't have Part 2. They didn't have Part 3. What we did get was Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation.
Mm-hmm.
The one that is quite, I guess you would say, infamous for starring Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey.
No editorial commenting here. I'm not a fan of either, but go ahead.
Well, Matthew McConaughey is
both terrible.
McConaughey is experiencing a bit of a resurgence. But anyway.
Even those car ads.
Well, okay, whatever. True Detective and whatever.
Yeah.
So the reputation of Texas Chainsaw, I mean, it was always loom large in my brain. I always thought to myself, okay, well, this movie, this is the be-all and end-all of horror. And so I took home Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, popped it in and was absolutely appalled. Not by the horror, not by the gore, but just how bad the movie was. It was a terrible movie. And I'm watching it and I'm going to myself, this is Texas Chainsaw? I mean, this is what all the fuss is about?
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't believe it.
I did hear that the director wanted to remove his name from the credits and Alan Smithify himself.
Did he really?
From it, yeah.
Well, but wasn't Kim Henkel the director?
Oh, was it? Oh, I was thinking of the previous one. Sorry.
Okay, yeah.
No, anyway, that's it stands to, all of them were terrible, with the exception of two.
Two was good, but I mean, two was a bit of a parody. But anyway, Kim Henkel, who actually directed, who wrote the first Texas Chainsaw along with Tobe Hooper, directed this abysmal movie.
And it was supposed to be a return to form.
Yeah, it intended to be the real sequel, but it was garbage.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, at the same time, I'm like, I have to see Texas Chainsaw. I have to see the original. So I rented it. We have another pretty cool store called Bay Street Video. Rented it on DVD, popped it in, and from the very first frame, you know, you get that sort of like ponderous, voiceover by
John
Larroquette. Yeah.
This is a true story.
Yep, the events you're about to see is true, and then. And of course, at that point, I knew it wasn't a true story, but nonetheless, all the same, you know, all of a sudden you hear that I can't even imitate the sound, that camera, Gunner calls it a stinger in his book. Sound, like, right away, like, this is iconic, right? There's flashes of this and that.
Oh, the sunspots were unbelievable.
Right.
You knew something was, there was nothing like it.
Yeah.
You didn't know what it was, but you knew it was unsettling.
Totally. And I'm watching this movie, and all of a sudden, like, I'm like, okay, now this is the real deal. You know what I mean? Forget that garbage I saw. Like, this is something. And I mean, talk about the sound. I mean, you can watch that movie with the picture off, just the sound. Mm-hmm. And that's the sound is going to terrify you. I remember because, I mean, it was on DVD, so it was 5-point surround. I mean, the whirring chainsaws.
Oh, yeah.
The animalistic noises on the soundtrack. You know, there was pigs. There was cows. I mean,
it was... Gunnar Nelson.
Gunnar Hansen.
Oh, My bad.
Nelson. We're not talking about 90s boy bands.
He went to a farm to imitate how pigs squeal.
He did.
His character
squealed like a pig. Yeah,
squealed like a pig boy. Yeah, it's all coming back to Deliverance.
Yep.
Anyway, yeah, it's just all these sounds and images, and I guess it was loosely inspired by Ed Gein, this serial killer. What is it about Wisconsin? There's Jeffrey Dahmer and Ed Gein. Like, they're known for cheese and serial killers. I don't know why there's so many, but anyway, he took that bare bones story and ran with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, the Ed Gein, he's basically inspired a number of movies, Psycho being another one.
Oh, really?
A really, really very, very cool sort of underrated undersea movie called Deranged, right? But, I mean, there are similarities in the Ed Gein story to Texas Chainsaw, but it really isn't.
Basically, the skin masks that would have been, and the digging up of the corpses. But what in Psycho was inspired by Ed Gein?
Well, again, the wearing of the mask. I mean,
I see. Yeah. Okay,
and the
drag.
There might have been some sort of Oedipal complex. I'm not an expert on Ed Gein, but I don't know. But anyway,
that's a good thing to know.
Oedipal or anyway, whatever. So yeah, I'm watching Texas Chainsaw, and this film is getting to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here I am now. I mean, I'm no longer the kid that's afraid of my own shadow. I've got some horn in my belt, and I'm watching this movie. I remember, like, that very first scene when you see Leatherface, when the door opens, and there he is, like, this imposing figure, and boom,
sledgehammer. That was it. Death immediately.
You know what I mean?
No foreshadowing or anything. No chase. Just, yeah, that shocked the hell out of me.
He slams the door, and you're like, what the hell did I just see?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's a testament to Gunnar Hansen's performance, because, I mean, this guy, very, no dialogue, animalistic noises here and there, basically body language.
Oh, of course. And the audience was anticipating the hitchhiker to be the one who would go apeshit and massacre everyone in the van.
Mm-hmm.
And of course they mess with expectations. And well, he's psychopathic and deranged and cutting himself and everything.
That's not where
it went. They let him go. And who would have thought that? A hitchhiker. It's like almost a cliche. You pick up the weirdo hitchhiker and then he, you know, something untoward happens. But this, they let him out and everything seems to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
But then this giant guy who, I guess, Tobe Hooper cast him because he filled out the door frame.
That's what he said.
So forget about a nice read. Oh, like you're a Sir Anthony Hopkins-esque read of your lines. No.
Yeah.
He was 6'4", 6'5". He filled out the frame.
Yeah.
Great.
6'4", and then they gave him three heels. Yeah. 6'7".
Yeah.
No, actually, it's funny you mentioned the hitchhiker because that's another thing too. I mean, when we meet the I guess you would say protagonist of the movie,
mm-hmm.
The kids in the van, and you're introduced to the character of Franklin, played by Paul Partain.
Yeah, differently abled, handicapped
indeed.
Guy. That was way ahead of its time to put even forget about. Just what any character who has some sort of disability in a film was way ahead of its time. Forget about the fact that he could have been a sympathetic character, but he really isn't. He's an asshole.
Oh my God! I mean,
he's a terrible man.
He's just this annoying guy. I mean, like, yeah. you want to see the guy suffer. You want to see him. You want to
suffer more than he already has.
You want to see exactly pain inflicted upon this character.
He's a paraplegic. How much more suffering do you want him to have?
Right. But he was whiny. He was, oh God. And yeah, so they pick up this hitchhiker played incredibly by not Ed O'Neill, Ed Neill.
Ed Neill, sorry.
And right away, all of a sudden, this sort of off-kilter sort of...
strange dynamic, yeah.
That is a bit of a cliche, picking up the hitchhiker, and the hitchhiker oftentimes becomes,
but offset by, a disabled person in the van. It's just really incredible to see and really quite shocking. And he later on erased any sort of sympathies anyone might have had for him. And initially, I guess he was rolled down a hill. Then afterward, as he's, with that whiny voice and looking for his friends, you just figure, just let him be, just let him loose in the woods. Don't push him around anymore. Just let him be, let him be cannon fodder for the family while you get away.
Now, amazingly enough, Partain, I mean, the guy was a method actor. Mm-hmm. So he was like that on set 24/7. And Gunnar Hansen said he could not stand Paul Partain. He could not wait for that scene when he actually managed to carve him up with a chainsaw.
And the rest of the cast said they had no dealings with Gunnar Hansen.
Because he stunk.
He stunk, and also because it was the dynamic of there's the innocence and the annoying guy, and then the killers, and they all separated. Until, after which point any one of them was murdered, then they would associate with each other. Otherwise, they stayed separate. And that, I think, added to the drama, because unlike a lot of these films, it was incredibly well acted.
Oh, without a doubt.
I
just want to clarify when I say he stunk. I don't mean he stunk as an actor. I mean,
he literally stunk.
They were filming in 100 plus degree Texas heat. I mean, the guy had, it was a shoestring production, very low budget.
Yeah, so they were not laundering the outfits.
They didn't have, the change of clothing. I mean, they would wear the same outfits day in, day out. And yeah, so I mean, they were quite ripe. But getting back to Partain, Hansen said that years later he met Paul Partain.
Yeah, he was a cool dude.
Is an abled guy.
Yeah.
And he said he was a great guy. Yeah. He was so immersed in his role that
he wanted to be the biggest, wheelchair bound jerk.
The whiniest, most annoying. Flint. Yeah. So we have these, one, two, three, five kids in the van?
I think so, yeah.
And they're heading up to the ancestral home of one of the kids, and sometimes you just take that wrong turn and you end up in the wrong place at the wrong time, and that's sort of what happened. I mean, there was no real rhyme or reason for these kids to get killed.
No.
With the exception of Partain, who was an annoying little shit. They were good kids. They wandered to the wrong house, and
they wanted to do was hang out and hit the local swimming hole,
relax. Yeah. And they weren't even fornicating, or smoking pot.
Shockingly,
exactly.
Nudity didn't precipitate any of these killings.
No.
Although we would have liked to see a little bit.
Marilyn
Burns.
In retrospect, it would have taken away from the effectiveness of the movie. But probably, going back, right. Yeah. So I guess we should talk about Marilyn Burns a bit. I mean, Marilyn Burns is, I would say she's I wouldn't say the proverbial, but the archetypical...
final girl.
Final female. What this poor woman went through, I mean, it's funny because a lot of the... I guess at this point, you're not really spoiling the movie. I mean, those that are listening have seen the movie, I would hope, right? But...
hey, if it's a movie about a bunch of psychopathic, chainsaw-wielding killers...
cannibalistic.
Yeah, it's not like you could give any possible spoilers.
Right. But, I mean, everybody meets their demise, their untimely demise, pretty quickly, but poor Marilyn Burns goes through quite the ordeal, both on celluloid and off.
Yeah.
And, including the dinner scene, which we'll talk about in a moment or two, but this woman, God, did she know how to scream.
Yeah, incredible.
And she knew how to scream. One thing she didn't know how to do is run, apparently. Gunnar said that despite the fact that he was a giant, he would usually
catch up to her with his strides. So I guess he would stop in the woods and, chainsaw
he would just all of a sudden
trees to just let her get away.
So she would keep... I mean, the thing is, you talk about, this, in a way, this was cinema verite. In a lot of ways, the injuries that the actors and actresses were incurring were real.
Yeah.
The blood you saw was real. When Marilyn Burns got her hair tangled in the tree, it was really tangled in the tree. The chainsaw was real. They had a dummy chainsaw but most of the time they would use a real chainsaw.
Yeah.
The blades were whirring. I mean, it was constant danger. apparently the shoot was, it was hell. And Neil did a tour of duty in Vietnam.
Really?
And he did, yeah. And he said that that was nothing compared to his time on the set of Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, I was just going to say, most of the time when there's a chase in a movie, that's mm-hmm. when I tune out. And I just, yes. chases are just, it's just filler to me, and they're frequently not done well. But this, I mean, was just harrowing stuff.
Oh my God, you just want to see.
I couldn't believe it. And yeah, it's just the way it was lit and the way they were just cutting through the branches. I was just riveted.
And there was, I mean, like, all you want to see was some vestige of, like, sanity, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That Marilyn Burns would sort of, like, or her character, Sally, some sanctuary she could find. I mean, yeah. And every time that she would, like, you know, to sort of quote The Godfather, every time she was out there, keep pulling her back in.
Yeah.
Know, I mean,
The Sopranos quoting The Godfather.
Yeah. there's, you know, I mean, she goes to the gas station, and there's the kindly cook that we saw met earlier in the movie, and he's part of the clan, right?
Yeah, I guess the psycho at the gas station, that's a sort of trope that's been revisited a number of times. Where the hard partying frat people go yep. out into the Virginia or the Georgia woods, and they stop for gas and they meet some loon. But of course, in this case, I guess it's sort of foreshadowed that he's a loon, but they put it enough to bed that you would not think he'd come back to haunt them again. But he really does, which was quite shocking. There was enough distance between the two. Yeah,
yeah. And that's the thing, too. I mean, when you watch a movie as influential as Texas Chainsaw is, like, I mean, when you watch it through today's eyes, you know, fresh, I mean, you're sort of watching through the lens of all the films as sort of either paid homage
to it off,
or ripped it off.
Same thing with Monty and Python. The influence is so widely cast.
Yeah, so in a sense, it's almost like it feels watered down. It doesn't feel as original. But when you look back and say, well, this was the granddaddy of them all. This is what originated these tropes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
It really, it has a lot more impact. So the dinner scene is incredible because here you have Sally, whose brother's been slain, her friends have been slain. She's going through hell and back. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's escaped. She's been brought back over and over again. All of a sudden, she finds herself sitting at this table.
At the head of the table, and almost so for comic effect, and this is sort of a weird sort of dining scene.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess ironic because the house where they filmed this is now a restaurant. So
It was. I believe it's now been torn down.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, I believe the house was torn down, or I guess there was two of them.
Well, Gunnar, in Gunnar's book, he said there was one time when he enjoyed a really nice steak at this restaurant, but it's no longer there.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. you got the hitchhiker, who, you know, there was some distance, but there he is again. You got
the weirdo gas station attendant.
You got the gas station. You got
the masked killer.
And there you got the masked killer.
The nubile women, one of whom was cast as the braless female protagonist, and that was it. Really no backstory other than they're going out to have fun somewhere.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here they are sitting around this dinner table in sort of warped, kind of like Norman Rockwell-esque dinner scene. But I mean,
a movable feast, or not really movable.
Right. Or actually what they call on set was the Last Supper.
Oh, okay. Even that, yeah.
And they bring down Grandpa, played by John Dugan, right? Mm-hmm. Grandpa's 106 years old.
Yeah.
And,
he's dead, right?
No, he's not dead. He's alive, but barely.
Oh, really? Yes. I took it that he was sort of involved. I guess that's probably a contentious point as well for viewers.
I'll tell you why.
Meant to be alive.
He's alive. He's alive.
Okay.
He's very much alive. I mean, he's
very much. The fact that he can't move a single limb or respond in any kind of way. He's a vegetable.
But I mean, you know, the family holds him in great esteem.
Yeah.
And they want him
to do the kill.
They want him to do the kill. But another thing that was quite interesting is
the final kill. Yeah.
But before that, I mean, the cast. Okay. One thing I want to say about Tobe Hooper. I don't remember where this is attributed to, but I was reading a quote about Texas Chainsaw, and they said, you watch a film by Hitchcock, right? You know you're in the hands of a master. Of a master.
Yeah.
You watch Texas Chainsaw, you're in the hands of a maniac. Uh-huh. You don't know what the hell is going on, right? There is no safety. There's no reassurance. And there was no safety reassurance for the cast.
No.
And in the scene when they cut Sally's finger, Gunner is basically supposed to use a prop knife with fake blood.
Yeah.
And it wasn't working. And Gunner, who's like, he's a nice guy. He's a sensitive guy. He was a teacher. He was a poet. He's like, you know what? Forget this. I'm just going to cut her finger for real. I'm not going to tell her. He did it. Wow. He thought it was an accident. He didn't realize until 20 years later at a convention when he told her he really cut her finger. He cut her finger for real. all of a sudden, there you have John Dugan's grandpa sucking
the real blood.
The real blood, yeah. Not even knowing that. I mean, adding to the sort of cinema verite sort of documentary.
Well, not to mention the fact that Gunner nearly killed himself in the chase scene. Maybe. Where he went flying and the chainsaw went north. He went south and he didn't know where it was going to land.
Right.
So if things had taken a different turn, he might have been a victim of the movie. And then cinema verite right there. You know what?
Knowing Toby Hooper, he would have kept on rolling. He would have made it to the final cut. But anyway. Yeah. So, I mean, there's that. And, of course, Grandpa's... I mean, there is humor in Texas Chainsaw. I mean, it's black humor. But, I mean, the scene when Grandpa's trying to give
the final whack.
Give a final whack. Yeah. I mean, he can barely hold the... That's probably why he thought he was dead.
Yeah.
I mean, you know. But it's nuts. And then eventually, you know, she manages to escape. And it's just harrowing. I mean, there's no safe resolution.
No.
Even when she makes her... I mean, she is the last girl standing, right? But we know for a fact that this woman is wrecked for life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Based upon what she went through, what she saw in that house, in that that Texas farmhouse. The killers are still at large. I mean, one of them met their demise. I won't say who, in case there is somebody who still hasn't seen the movie and isn't going to get spoiled.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, you have Leatherface sort of dancing in the sun, in the sunrise.
Doing an impromptu dance, which was just creepy as hell.
Yeah.
That's something you would never see. And really, he has, for a guy who's masked with no dialogue other than squeals, pig-like squeals, he really is.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible performance. And he brings much more humanity to it than you know, 7 or 8, or however many there are, Friday the 13th films, for sure.
And so, in our last podcast, I mean, you mentioned that we always root for the protagonist, we never root for the antagonist, but I mean, there is some sympathy, I think, for Bubba, for Leatherface. I mean, in this sense,
he researched his role, at a home for the challenged, and sort of reproduce their actions and their movements to try and give his character a sense of that, which I guess in the one hand could be called exploitation, but on the other hand, it really does give him sympathy, because that's, you could tell he was under the thumb of the patriarchs of that family.
Yeah, and there's that. And the other thing too is, you got to remember, I mean, these are people, I mean, this is their home, this is their castle, right? They're being invaded.
Yeah, in a way.
They're being invaded. I mean, you know, they're not going out hunting down, you know, Sally and her friends. Sally and her friends are invading their domicile. You know what I mean? They've
it's
already been
like he's got a little bit of OCD or some sort of, you know, and so it's, he's being, his space is being disrupted.
Well, I was almost gonna say, it's almost like a little, like straw dogs, you know, with peck and paw, you know, like, you know, defend the castle. So I mean,
Dustin Hoffman, he was not in Star Wars and he was not in Texas Chainsaw.
There you go. Yeah. There's a dinner on that one. But anyway, so I mean, there is some sympathy for the antagonists. But of course, ultimately, you want to see at least one person
get away.
But anyway, so so when I watched a movie in my 20s, I mean, it affected me. It shook me. I mean, it didn't keep me up at night, but I mean, it's a movie I've revisited over and over and over again. And every time I see it, I mean, I'm just amazed at how bloody
every scene,
this
every
movie.
Scene has something to commend.
Yeah, and when
fantastic
I say
fantastic acting, great writing, like just even the, like the the tree, like the you know the I guess it was plates hanging from the tree.
Oh, I mean, we got to talk about the set design. Burns. I mean,
Bob Burns, who went on to work on Reanimator, which is one of our favorite movies
indeed,
of all time.
Indeed, I mean, that
is incredible. The lengths he went to stock this house full of roadkill, essentially.
Roadkill and sort of like weird sort of totems made out of bones and live
getting
chickens.
Back to the Godfather, as you mentioned earlier, they had a chance to put a dead horse in this thing, and they didn't because they're worried it would be too gory. And
speaking
so they found a dead horse at the side of the road, decided to replace it with a dead armadillo.
Armadillo, that's
and
right,
I would
that's
love
right.
it if they had any leftover horse footage. That would have been super cool.
A couple more things I want to say. Daniel Pearl, the cinematography was unbelievable. The scene where I can't remember her name, but when she walks toward the house and the house swallows her up. I mean, that
the
was
swing set just, scene is
exactly
incredible,
absolutely
incredible.
Iconic. So Chris, I mean, obviously the film has grown in your estimation, right?
Oh, for sure.
I mean, it's I would put it up there. I mean, not only is it one of the best horror films I've ever seen, it's one of the best films I've ever seen. I mean, Texas Chainsaw is the granddaddy
except
of them all.
Except no imitators.
Exactly. And unfortunately, some of those imitators were sequels, you know, inferior sequels. Part two is great. We have a review of it on the site, but it's a completely different beast entirely. Bit of a parody, sort of going for laughs, you know, taking a bit of the black humor of the first one.
Yeah, and intentionally going for laughs rather than injecting black humor into morbid subject matter, which doesn't really work for this genre.
Funny enough, starring Dennis Hopper, who claimed that it was the worst one he's ever appeared in.
Yeah, I've seen Waterworld.
This man that was in Waterworld, the Super Mario Brothers, yeah. But anyway. So the less said about the sequels and the remakes, the better. The original stands on its own. I mean, there's not even a point in giving it a rating. It's 5-star all the way.
For sure.
And Texas Chainsaw Massacre, accept no substitutes.
For sure. Go out and see it. And for more, check out our site, www.reallyawfulmovies.com. We'll talk to you soon. Thank you.